This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your polo sock takedown of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
My left stroke just went viral.
Right stroke put lil' baby in a spiral. Soprano C, we like to keep it on the high note. It's levels to it, you and I know. Tell them be humble. Holla. Sit down. Holla. Be humble. Holla. Sit down.
Ooh, it's hard to be humble, but I'm going to try. That was Kendrick Lamar's Humble. And this week on Popcast, we're going to talk about Kendrick's new album, Damn, J. Cole's For Your Eyes Only, and some of the bigger picture surrounding GOAT culture in hip hop and greatest rapper alive conversations, generational divides. And I am joined by James Braxton Peterson. What's good, James?
What up, man?
James is the director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University. James is a contributor to MSNBC and the host of The Remix on WHYY. And most importantly, James and I go back. James, can I open this up by just sort of saying when we met?
Yeah, give them some context.
Give a little context. It's important to know that there was a time where you and I were treading the same path.
Yep.
And I'm thinking 1997, 1998, London. Both James and I were pursuing graduate degrees, and one of us didn't drop out. So I'd like to congratulate James for sticking it out.
Thanks, bruh. But listen, there were certain things you saw through back then, things that were transparent to you about the academy, even when we were in London. That took me a few more years to get a grasp.
I mean, that is facts. I'm not going to deny that. We were knocking around in the academy, both working on stuff very close to what we're working on now, albeit in very different contexts. James has a gang of books out. I looked on your Amazon page. It seems like you drop a book every 6 months, like Future. You like the Future of Hip Hop Academia. Oh, my goodness. We come from a similar academic training.
Right.
And I should at least shout out, you know, the good Dr. Cornell West and, of course, Paul Gilroy. Who are your mentors? Who were you studying with at that time? Because Paul introduced us, I think.
That's right. Gilroy did. And I mean, for folks who don't know Paul Gilroy, towering Africana studies scholar, really put the definitive touches on Black British modernity.
Yep.
and giving a sense of the ways in which Black American music kind of flows throughout the world.
Very important. Read the Black Atlantic right now.
One of the most off-cited academic texts in the history of academic
texts. And also, I mean, while you're at it, if you really want some deep cuts, get that There Ain't No Black in the Union Jack anthology. Like, just get all the mixtapes, too, while you're at it.
Yeah, and Paul Gilroy had me over to his house for tea and soup while I was there. He was at Queens College at the time, and he introduced me to the Cookie Crew. It's like the British salt and pepper, you know. But he also, yes, he introduced us. And, you know, we hung out a little bit in London. Mm-hmm. London, we were in London at a crazy time, which was London was really beginning to come into its own, which is to say hip-hop artists were making deliberate departures from rhyming with American accents.
Yes.
And you know, you had Ty and Shorty Blitz blowing up. 279 was
Skinny
was
Man.
Yep, all that stuff. You know, Black Twang, all those mm-hmm. guys were really bubbling while we were. So it was a really dope scene.
One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you specifically about this subject matter is I feel like, and this is, I want to lay some frameworks out, which is, I think that there is a real, I don't want to say generational bias, but I do think that there is a bit of groupthink that happens with Kendrick specifically. I think especially for writers of a younger generation and thinkers of a younger generation, Kendrick embodies the best of what hip hop has to offer. He is often used both as a narrative, but also as a counter narrative up against the perceived ills of the hip hop mainstream. And I think that's a valuable role to play and a valuable perspective to have. But I also think that there are other ways to look at Kendrick that I think a little bit of a historical perspective will help with. I know in your heart, I felt like you had some things to say about that. So let's start with Damn. I wrote about Damn. I want to hear your feelings about Damn as a sort of standalone project before we kind of get into big picture Kendrick talk.
Sure. I mean, and hard for me to talk about Damn without thinking about the larger picture within which people frame Kendrick. Is kind of an HD panoramic view, and we really need like a 3D
yes.
HD view to fully appreciate, I think, Kendrick and all his complexities. So for a long time, and sorry, I had to do a little big picture. For a long time, I felt like K-Dot was making music that, in a lot of ways, appealed to a more mature hip-hop audience.
Yep.
And I don't think he was doing that self-consciously or deliberately. I think Damn is his most self-conscious record, and I guess that's a little bit pejorative, but not really, right? But it's the reason why I say it creates dissonance is because it's the first record that K-Dot has made that I can really understand the distance between myself listening to it and enjoying it and thinking about it and my son listening to it, enjoying it and thinking
about it. Oh, interesting.
Right. So my son is 17, he'll be 18 soon. Mm-hmm. Both my kids are teenagers. They both love this record. And I'll tell you later on about why they love it and what they're like playing with the record.
Yeah.
But those are not the things that are appealing to me, right? And so I think it's a solid record. I'm learning more and more that I have to pay more attention to visuals.
Yes. The videos that have been put out for this album are consistently excellent. And I think, unlike sort of the Beyoncé Lemonade effect where she dropped it all at one time and sort of trained the fan to expect them, Kendrick is dropping them. I don't know if they're sequential, but he's dropping them one at a time. And I worry they have maybe a little less impact than they should because they're just kind of like dropping out of nowhere, you know.
Out of nowhere.
Yeah, like I worry about that.
Well, listen, I mean, I'm a sucker for Don Cheadle. So you put Don Cheadle in a rap video and I'm like, yo! Hey! You know? But Humble was a great video as well.
Yeah.
And I'm not one of these critics or scholars of the culture that kind of like have these fake eureka moments like, oh, now that I've heard Humble on the record, I realize he's talking about himself.
Right.
I'm not in that camp, but the visuals in the video for Humble, to me, it's, I mean, some of those scenes are just striking and reminiscent from some of the visuals from To Pimp a Butterfly.
Yeah.
So I think I want to pay more attention to those visuals. I think both those videos have been incredible. Again, the album is great. Let me just break down my flow with it. So this record for me from Pride on is really amazing. I mean, I'll come around to the earlier pieces of it, I'm sure, but Pride is the first song on the record that pulls me into my, like, my deep space in terms of listening and trying to kind of like feel how the music resonates with me. I'm not just because of the content of it, but also because of the musical aesthetics of it. It's just slower and it's a little bit darker, and that's kind of where my tastes are.
And I also think that, I mean, just to be fair, on this record, the second half is better than the first half. I mean,
yeah,
let's
thank
just,
you, Mr. Music Critic.
That's
for
fine.
It.
I mean,
this is
what we do. And the thing is, someone, you know, there is such a high level of reverence around Kendrick because of the nature of his gifts that I think sometimes proper criticism can kind of get blocked off a little bit. And I think it's important that we hold sort of even our most acclaimed and most impressive artists offer criticism that's loving criticism of them as much as we would of someone that we don't like as much. Because I think that's sort of the ideal creative ecosystem where everyone is engaged at a high level. The creators are engaged at a high level and the thinkers are engaged at a high level. Okay, so To Pimp a Butterfly, to me, is still the best Kendrick Lamar record. And it is...
Without question.
And it is the most difficult Kendrick Lamar record, I want to say, musically and also lyrically. And I think that is where...
And Subject Matter Wise.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that is where he excels. And I think if there's something that I take away from Damn, I don't want to say feels like a placeholder, because that I don't want to short sell it. But it reminds me a little bit of Drake's If You're Reading This, It's Too Late, which is, obviously, they're very
Listen,
different.
You're only going to get three Drake references in this whole conversation.
Okay.
That's your
but
first
this,
one, okay?
But, this is the, but that's fine, because I'm going to make it count. So the thing with that record is it was the first time that I think Drake stepped aside from what I think he excelled at in order to kind of make a side point, but the side point took a whole album to make, which is... I'm feeling aggrieved. I'm feeling put upon. I'm going to change the nature of my music for 3 months, 6 months, whatever it is, as a way of letting people know not only that I'm capable of doing that, but also that my mood has changed. Damn feels like that to me. I hear it in the musical choices, which are more punchy, I think, than what you heard on the last record. I hear that in the lyrical choices in terms of the way that he's rapping. He's except for a couple of tracks towards the end of the record, he's de-emphasizing some of the narrative work that he did. He's using what I think of as rapper tricks, like returning to the same phrase over and over again. I feel this, I feel this. The thing that Kendrick has always been exceptional at is he's an incredible rapper who doesn't lean too hard on rapper tricks, and this album has a lot of rapper tricks on it.
Right. Well, so let me just speak to that. First of all, everyone, please take a moment and pray for Kendrick, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Please
True.
Pray
for Kendrick. He's asking for it.
He's asking. Please pray for him. I agree with you on the rapper tricks piece, but I would say this. There was a little bit of that in To Pimp a Butterfly as well, but the phrase, like, for example, he says, you know, you can spend all your, I don't know if you can curse on your show, but you
we'll yeah, bleep you can, it. It's cool.
You can spend all your, you know, money at the mall if you want to, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of the critique of conspicuous capitalism and materialism kind of is a refrain in To Pimp a Butterfly, right? Now, here he chooses, you know, pray for me. And this is, to me, the difference between these two records, but also in some ways between what I think of as classic records versus really, really good hip-hop records, mm-hmm. which is, you know, when he's making that commentary about you can go spend all your money at the mall, that's for us. That's for everybody. He's critiquing himself. He's challenging and checking his own materialism, but also all of ours. When he's saying, pray for me, you know, that's mm-hmm. about him.
Yes.
And this is what's challenging for me about that. I'm going to pray for him on a real for real. But the other sort of piece to this is that this is an odd moment to me for the kind of, and this is going to sound negative, but I don't mean it this way, but for the kind of navel-gazing that this record reflects for me.
You mean an odd social moment, an odd political moment.
For the guy who people revere so much for being so incisive sociopolitically to be kind of focused a little bit on himself and his challenges. I mean, and K-Dot's not going to take any advice from me, but I would say, dude, you've got to shift your focus to a different area of your fan base. And so I think he hears a lot from those who revere him. And I don't want to paint with broad strokes.
That's a cold critique, James.
Listen, a lot of the critical reverence doesn't have the substance that I would like to see in terms of how we engage. Just that whole point you just made about artists at the highest level, critics at the highest level, scholars at the highest level, listeners at the highest level. I don't know if he's hearing enough from his listeners at the highest level, because I feel as if, you know, he is chastising some of his fans. And I think he is pushing back in some not so subtle ways against the reverence that he's sort of enjoyed, I think, over the course of his short career, but not paying enough attention to those folks who are more critically engaged. I think for him ultimately will lead to more of this kind of malaise. There are folks who are on social media talking about the Black Israelite comment, talking about the fact that his gender politics haven't advanced so much. Trying to think with him about, look, if you're going to be Kung Fu Kenny, right? You want to play Kung Fu with all the folks who are taking jabs at you, Fox News, some of your critics, to some of your fans, even some of your family, some folks in your inner circle, right? If you're going to do that, let's play intellectual Kung Fu, Mr. Kung Fu Kenny. Kendrick never has to dumb down his music.
No, the point you just made is so important, because I think to see how he uses Fox News as this kind of punching bag, which seems to me to be punching below his weight. These are not sophisticated critiques. These are the critiques of white outsiders and conservative outsiders. Like the things that you mentioned as far as what the Twitter conversation about some of Kendrick's struggles are, I see those conversations happening every day online.
Yep.
I think if Kendrick really wants to engage with critique, if he really is telling you that he is aware of what is being said about him and wants to offer something back, I think saying, well, Fox News said something bad about me feels very like 1994 to me. You know what I mean? It feels very Tipper Gore era. And we're beyond that. And Kendrick is beyond that. So it was very striking that of all the sort of things that he pushes back on, that's what he pushes back on.
And I agree, John, but let me also just say, here's a piece of the generational gap. Teenage listeners to Kendrick love that he attacks Fox News.
Mm.
And let me tell you something. They're in their circles. The fact that Bill O'Reilly just got fired is because of Kendrick Lamar, right? Right. So like, I mean, seriously, like, so this is where the age gap matters. For young folks in their teenagers and young 20s, they haven't really paid that much attention to Fox. You're right. We've paid much more attention to them over the long haul. We've seen seen the demonization in a much more radical way, by the way, over the long haul of the history of the demonization of black folks, demonization of women. We've seen it. They haven't seen it so much. For them, Fox News kind of emerged with Trumpism. And so and young folks hate Trumpism.
Right.
And so as a critique of that, you know, they're like using genius to like figure out every single allusion to Fox News so they can count them up and figure out what their conspiracy theory is for the Kendrick Lamar's role in the demise of Bill O'Reilly.
I'd like to read that. I'd like to read that reported out, if possible. I want to know if any of the Murdoch kids.
It's going to be
listening.
On a Snapchat streak between like a couple of teenagers.
It could, yes. Although I wonder. I mean, as you know, we all know that James Murdoch is a former owner of Raucous Records. You know, maybe he was listening to Damn and was just like, I can't take the heat, Kenny. I gotta fix this. Someone got to report that out. Emily Steele, report that out.
Please, somebody get on that quickly.
But also, it's interesting you talk about this being an unusual political moment for Kendrick to choose to begin to turn inward. And he acknowledges this on Element, which let's listen to a little bit of Element here.
Here we go!
I don't give a f***. 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 I don't give a f***.
I'm willing to die for it. I done cried for it, might take a lie for it. Put the Bible down and go out for a knife for it. D.O.T. my enemy won't catch a vibe for it. Ayy, I've been stumped out in front of my mama. My daddy commissary made it to commas. Tell him all my grandma's dead, so ain't nobody praying for me, I'm on your head. Ayy, 30 millions later, no defense watching. Auntie on my telegram like, be cautious. I be hanging out at Tams, I be on Stockton.
This podcast is supported by Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life, a podcast that asks, how do we build a radically inclusive, thriving, multiracial democracy? Longtime equity advocate Angela Glover-Blackwell looks at movement, struggle, and progress in Los Angeles to see what it can teach the nation about building a democracy that represents everyone. Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Judson Jones. I'm a reporter and meteorologist at the New York Times. There's a tendency in weather reporting to have these sensational headlines to drive clicks because a lot of places have to rely on clicks for revenue. At the Times, because we're subscriber funded, we don't always have to use crazy terms like bomb cyclone or monster hurricane when we're covering extreme weather. We're not chasing clicks. We can just tell you the facts of what a storm could actually do, because trust is a crucial part of good journalism. If you want to support this kind of work and subscribe to the New York Times, go to nytimes.com/subscribe. I don't have to say ginormous hail.
He acknowledges this, you know, he has that line where he's like, last LP, I tried to help the black artists, but there's a difference between black artists and whack artists, which is a very awkwardly phrased line. Yeah. So I would have liked to have seen maybe a less awkwardly phrased line. But the point is, he says, and he said this, actually, he did an interview with T, which is the Time Style magazine, a few months ago. And I think he talked even then about stepping away from the sense of personal responsibility that drove him to make To Pimp a Butterfly and really, really looking inward on this record. Do you think that he feels his work is done? Or do you think that he feels that the pressures that are being put on him are now so loud and so intense that he has to address them and can't look outward in the same way right now?
Right. He can't possibly think that his work is done, right?
I mean, it's not. I mean, it's not. Yeah, I mean, we can agree that.
But here's the thing. He didn't make All Right for it to be an anthem. Like, All Right is not an intentional song in terms of the life of that song. And I think that the sort of enormous weight of that is more pronounced for him when he sees Schoolboy Q drop Blank Face, and especially when he sees Isaiah Rashad drop Son's Tirade, you know, records that I'm sure he listened to before we even had a chance to listen to.
Uh-huh.
He's seeing his colleagues, his immediate like team, drop records that aren't very self-conscious, that are dope-ass hip-hop records that are not, I mean, they're slightly political here and there, but they're not weighted in the way that To Pimp a Butterfly is, and I think that's appealing to him.
Yeah.
And so I think part of, you know, he's framing it as, look, I'm looking inward, but I think he's also looking at his camp and seeing them drop, like, really, really dope rap records, and he's like, yo, I'm I should be able to do that too.
And this is, I think, part of why Humble was the first song. Because Humble is that real, that nasty, I just keep wanting to curse. It's that, you know, I'm about it talk. You know, it's that talk.
Yeah.
And I have been waiting for some talk from Kendrick for a while now. Because I can tell embedded in the last record, I can tell that this is in him and this is part of what he's about. It was interesting to see some of the online conversation about that song, where I think there were some people who didn't totally understand that that was part of the Kendrick Lamar
proposition. No, John, most people initially, some of even our friends and colleagues, they wanted to read that as, oh, who's he dissing now? Is he dissing Big Sean? Is he coming at Drake? And I'm like, that doesn't even make, did you guys listen to you or did you watch the video or anything? Like, I mean, have you guys actually been listening to Kendrick Lamar records? It just seems silly to me to interpret that as him talking about other artists when so much of his work previous to Damn has all also looked inward, right? Like he has taken a look at himself, and you're right, he's been, I would say in some ways muted, but certainly restrained in the extent to which he lets you see Compton Kenny.
Yes.
Right? I mean, that's that you're seeing a little bit more of that here on this record.
I think this is, I don't want to say it's a return to that, but it is an acknowledgement. And this is, I think, because Kendrick and To Pimp a Butterfly became so aligned with the movement, I think Kendrick the rapper, Kendrick the guy who enjoys rapping, that got shunted to the side.
Yeah.
And now, to your point, this might be an unusual moment for that part of Kendrick to kind of like come back to the fore. But I do think part of the reason we're seeing it is, as you were saying earlier, a reaction to the intensity of the response. Because like you, I think you're right when you say All Right was not an intentional song.
Right.
But I do think All Right was speaking to a larger thing that was already happening. It just so happened to converge with a larger movement, you know, down the line. But in my mind, I don't know that Kendrick wants to be defined as that artist. I think he also values the kind of skill game that was so important to us growing up in the 80s and 90s.
Absolutely. I'll take that one step further and just say that he doesn't want to be defined externally at all.
Mm.
And if you think about, you know, think about the night after he wins the Grammy for I, right? What does he do? He drops Black of the Berry.
Uh-huh.
And this is the very moment where people are like, oh man, I, these, Kendrick is crossing over, is the pop star stuff, you know, like, oh, we're losing Kendrick. And then boom, the Black of the Berry, right? You thought you were defining him one way. He's trying to define himself another way. Damn for Me, I think ultimately is going to be one of these self-definition records. It's almost like he could have called it Kendrick, right? In the sense that you're getting a little bit of his origin story, even more like if you think of Good Kid, Mad City as a day in the life of Kendrick,
yes,
or a day in the life of Kendrick looking at the hood panoramically, right? Damn is like autobiography almost. Like, this is what I'm built of. You know, this is my blood. This is my DNA. This is my history. And I think the whole Duckworth narrative, which I hope people can like appreciate now, you can tell me better whether or not it's like absolutely verifiable, but this is, to me, this is the triumph of the Black literati for me. Duckworth represents like the triumph of folks like me in this sense. And I don't know if your listeners have read Paul Beatty's Sellout.
Ooh.
But his father was someone who could, in the hood, in the immediacy of violent circumstances, find a way to talk himself out of that.
Yes, out of situations, yeah.
And talk other people out of violent situations. K-Dot points to that as the reason why he exists.
Actually, let's listen to some part of Duckworth, and then you guys can go home and listen to the rest of it.
His name was Ducky. He came from the streets to Robert Taylor home, Southside Project, Chirac, the Terror Dome. Drove to California with a woman on him and $500. They had a son hoping that he see college, hustling on the side with a 9-to-5 to freak it. Cadillac severely ride his son around on weekends. Three-piece special with his name on his shirt pocket. Cross the street from the projects, Anthony Plant the Rabbit. Stuck up the place before, back in 84. That's when affiliation was really 8 years of war. So many relatives telling us, selling us, devilish work, scaling us. Crime, intelligence, felonous, prevalent proposition with nines. Ducky was well aware, they robbed a manager and shot a customer last year. He figured he'd get on these good sides. Free chicken every time Anthony posted in line. Two extra biscuits, Anthony liked them and then let them slide. They didn't kill him, in fact it looked like they're the last to survive.
Pay attention, that one decision changed both of their lives. One curse at a time, reverse to manifest the good karma, and I tell you why. You take two strangers and put them in random predicaments. Give them a soul so they can make their own choices and live with it. 20 years later, them same strangers, you make them meet again. Inside recording studios where they reaping their benefits. Then you start reminding them about that chicken incident. Whoever thought the greatest rapper would be from coincidence? Because if Anthony killed Ducky, Top Dog could be serving life while I grow up without a father and die in a gunfight.
To your point about Duckworth, not only is it an autobiographical extension of the good kid Mad City Kendrick, but it also not only does Kendrick say, I wouldn't exist if not for these circumstances, he very directly draws his own skill set as a hybrid of those two people and those two propositions. And that's fascinating. I actually wondered, as I was listening to it, how does Kendrick's father feel about listening to Kendrick speak about Top Dog, you know, Anthony Tiffey, in almost the same kind of pseudo-reverent way and saying, I took as much, and I am here as much because of that man's choices as my father's choices.
Look, this is, I think, where the album is most rich for me, because again, triumph of the literati. Paul Beatty's sellout is perfect here. The legacy of being that N-word whisperer for KDOT forces him to think about what is his interface with his listeners. And I'm not talking about listeners like me and you or the majority of his white listeners. I'm talking about his Compton listeners. Does he have the capacity to speak to people in his hood the way that his father did and the way that Top Dog did? For him, I think those are the critical internal definition questions that he's starting to try to answer here, but I think they're going to haunt him for the rest of his career. Is it because, you know, a lot of people push back against, like, when he says stuff that the Black Lives Matter activists think pander to the right, like was it Vogue, the Vogue article where he says police will respect our lives and black folks respect our lives, or in The Black of the Berry when he talks about black-on-black crime, or on this record when he says there can't be any black power if black men are killing each other. He's testing the waters. He doesn't care if the activist class and the literati class say, oh, my God, you're giving the right wing the tools to talk about black-on-black crime.
Right.
There's no such thing as black-on-black crime. Well, wait a second. Yes, we know there's no such thing as black-on-black crime. All crime is committed intra-racially. But in KDOT's hood, it's a lot of black-on-black crime.
But here's a question. Do you believe that Kendrick Lamar is fundamentally conservative?
Okay.
We talked yesterday a little bit, and we talked a little bit about Christianity. And I wonder if you have given any thought to Kendrick's potential conservatism, and if it's there, how it relates to his Christianity.
Yeah, so most rappers are conservative, John. I hate to break it.
Damn.
They don't think they are.
Oh, you
right?
Dropped these bars today. You came to New York and you Millie rocked.
Look, most rappers are. I mean, you know, you can speak progressive themes and you can be associated with liberal ideas, but still be conservative in your intellectual constitution. But let me I wanted to distinguish this from the religious conversation in the following ways. There's a certain kind of conservatism in the black community that's about agency, and that's about black folks' self-help dealing with their own problems. And yes, Kendrick Lamar is conservative in that way. He's aware of the structures of poverty. He's aware of systematic racism, but he'll acknowledge those in the music. But he also wants to challenge people in his own hood
to think.
And so, yes, that is conservative, because if you really want to change Compton, I think you should focus on the structures of racism and poverty and the erosion of residential life in Compton, gentrification, the erosion of public education systems, all those things. Chance giving $1 million to Chicago public schools is actually will have more impact on those kinds of structures of poverty in his community than KDOT talking about there's no black power if black people are killing each other in his community, right? So he's conservative in that way. The reason why I want to distinguish it from the religious discussion is because I think people are getting the religious thing all wrong with Kendrick Lamar, like they did with 5%ers and other rappers who we love, like Wu-Tang Clan, Nas, Rakim.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear more about that. Before we say why they're wrong, what do you think the perception is? And then let's talk about why it's wrong.
I think the perception is that when rappers get religion, if it doesn't look the way that people think religion is supposed to look, like kind of the way that J. Cole embraces a sort of traditional redemptive narrative within Christianity, if it doesn't look like that, then for some reason the esoteric is coded as being regressive. All right? I should say at the outset, all religions have gender biases in them. And so to say that a rapper being religious means they're also gender biased to me is tautological and obvious. Not to dismiss that conversation, I just want to make folks clear that I understand that.
Sure.
But you have to, you can't appreciate Black Israelites or the 5% nation unless you experience it in the hood. And I don't mean to sound essentialist here at all, John. I just mean that people are experiencing
These things decontextualized.
Yes, they're experiencing the rhetoric of it and not the experience of it. You got to understand that. And I'm from Newark, New Jersey, cards on the table, okay? A place where the Black Israelites and the 5% nation thrive, okay? But if you can appreciate the following, they are extreme versions of certain religions. You know, Black Israelites, it is an extreme version of, like, Old Testament Christianity. And the 5% nation, they won't claim their religion, but they are an extreme version of the Nation of Islam, not to be confused with Islam, right? But if you're in an urban environment, if you're in the hood, if you're around folks who are completely disengaged from formal institutions of education, for whatever reasons, because they're terrible, because they're disconnected, whatever. When you see a young person get galvanized through the rhetoric of the Black Israelites, and these dudes are like on the street corners in the hood, talking 12 hours a day on like soap boxes, literally, okay? Or you see the 5%ers, how they greet themselves in the hood, how they drop knowledge and exchange knowledge. I mean, it is revolutionary, small r revolutionary, for inner city communities that young, mostly Black men, but also some women, get radicalized around a certain kind of reductive, admittedly reductive, intellectualism that I think is inspiring for folks who, if you've been around it. I've had family members in the 5% nation, and like me and my cousin have sat around and listened to hours of the Black Israelites on radio and in the hood. And again, it's not that I subscribe to all their views. I think people misunderstand and totally underestimate the value of that energy in the hood.
But
they
do you think
understand
that,
what
do
it
you,
means.
But do you think that Kendrick's relationship to Christianity, you're saying it feels simpatico to you with a sort of 5%er Black Israelites? Because in terms of that, I would say parallel Christianity narrative or parallel Islam narrative, Kendrick feels outside to you, or he feels more like a representative of a centrist Christian narrative?
I feel like he's outside. I feel like he has played a lot with the centrist Christian narrative theme, and he's found them wanting. And so the Black Israelite piece, even though I think even in the song he's acknowledging that he just has these theories floating around in his head.
Yeah, it feels unformed.
It's unformed, but he's looking for more radical iterations of some of the religious doctrines that he's already been exposed to. In Good Kid, Mad City, Christian redemption matters for him. It means something to him.
Yes.
His grandmother praying over him and his boys redeems them. And by the way, there are people who still read Good Kid, Mad City and read those scenes as just kids running around killing each other.
Right.
People will absolutely leave out the Christianity. And I know K-Dot knows that, because I know he's seen these critiques of that album as being the super violent record, right? So I think that pushes an artist to search for other ways of thinking through those themes. I just wish that we didn't have to see it all in process, right? Because I think on the other side of this, what the Black Israelites represent will be more rhetorical for K-Dot than actually believable and ideological.
I think that seems fair. I want to also say at this point to listeners to read, there are a couple pieces that talk about Kendrick and his relation to Christianity. I'm thinking Reggie Ogu's piece on BuzzFeed. I think Micah Peters just did a piece on The Ringer. So definitely seek those out. But let's maybe segue slightly and talk about how Kendrick's, not just Christianity, but the way that Kendrick uses that almost crypto-moralist streak, but through an aesthetics lens, not necessarily through a lifestyle lens, but through a lifestyle. Let's talk about that, how that also applies a little bit more broadly in contemporary hip-hop, because I think you see that in J. Cole, and you see that in Chance.
Absolutely.
The first is that God is better than the world's best thing. God is better than the best thing that the world has to offer.
Mad magnify, magnify, lift it on high. Spit a Spotify to qualify a spot on his side. I cannot modify, ratify. My mama made me apple pies, lullabies, and alibis. The book don't end with Malachi. Devil will win employee of the month by the dozen to one score in 3 years from the third when he doesn't. My village raised him a child, come through the crib and it's bussin'. You meet anyone from my city, they gon' say that we cousins. Shabak, Barak, edify. Electrify the enemy like Hedwig till he petrified. Any petty Peter Pettigrew could get the pesticide. 79th, 79th. I don't believe in science, I believe in signs. Don't believe in signing, I seen dollar signs. Color white, collar crime. Good God, the gift of freedom. Hosanna Santa invoked and woke up slaves from Southampton to Chatham Manor. My dream girls behind me feel like I'm James Early. The type of worship make Jesus come back a day early. With the faith of a pumpkin seed, size mustard seed here. For I will speak noble things as entrusted me. Only righteous, I might just shrug at the skullduggery. I couldn't stand to see another rapper lose custody. Exalt, exalt, glorify. Descend upon the earth with swords and fortify the borders where your shortest lies. I used to hide from God. Duck down in the slums like shh.
I remember a couple years ago, sort of as Cole was sort of putting out platinum records that no one in radio rap in the radio rap land cared about, and Chance was sort of creeping out of mixtapes into a more mainstream consciousness, really beginning to understand that there was an entire hip hop audience that either didn't see themselves in what we thought of as mainstream radio, you know, your Wayne's, your Drake's, etc., or who understood that something else in their soul needed to be spoken to, and artists like this were speaking to that. And so I'm curious what kind of threads you see between these hip-hop, you know, I don't even want to say counter-narratives. I remember back then I called it the silent majority, which was like sort of a little bit of an LOL term. But I was like, here's a bunch of guys who are putting out platinum records. And
right.
Most people who are casual observers of the genre wouldn't think twice about them. And now that was 2015.
Right.
In 2017, that's not a luxury anybody has anymore. I think if you are talking about where hip hop's moral, spiritual, and aesthetic center is,
Yeah. You
have to talk about this stuff. But tell me what you see in this kind of like counter narrative that's actually not counter.
Yeah, I mean, I, a couple of things here. One, I just want to, just because facts matter, folks should understand that hip hop has had a complicated and imbricated relationship with religion from almost the beginning. I mean, there was a lot more 5% Nation of Islam influence in some of the earlier popular hip-hop, but Christianity was almost always there. But one of the reasons why the drift of the epicenter of hip-hop has moved towards these three, particularly around certain religious themes within their music, I'm speaking of Chance, J. Cole, and Kendrick, is because all the little whoever, young whoever guys, they'll play around in this space, but they're much more invested in the Dionysian aesthetics of what the music represents.
Sure.
And people love that. But black folks are really religious. And you know what else? Americans, even though there's more and more atheists, Americans are still pretty freaking religious. And so they'll go with little whoever or young whoever on Saturday, but on some Sunday, they want to listen to Chance. And I think because those guys have been adept, particularly Chance, at making sure that in his records, J. Cole does no features. Chance does all features with those guys.
Yes.
And so that fusion of the secular and sacred is becoming something that's more and more appealing, but partially because the secular is dominant in American 21st century. There will be more and more atheists. There will be a sort of bleeding out of the religious ethos in American culture. So the secular will maintain.
Just to add one thing to your Saturday versus Sunday idea, which is it's not just Saturday night versus Sunday morning. It's also different relationship structures. It's my friends versus my family.
Yep.
It's my generation versus my elders.
Yep.
It's and the thing that is most, I think, encouraging for me as someone who has watched and thought hard about the genre for 30 years is hip hop now solves all of those problems.
Yep.
Because I remember a time when it didn't solve all those problems, or at least it wasn't established enough and varied enough to address all of those things. And now you quite literally do have a rapper or an album or a song for almost any relationship in your life. You can have a Chance song between you and your religious grandmother.
That's
makes
exactly
a lot
right.
of sense. And that resonates for her as well as for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's the accretion of the form over time too, right? Like, you know, there are a lot of freaking hip hop songs, and so you got to, hopefully you're exploring new territory. These three guys invested in exploring new territory, at least as much as they can within the aesthetic realms that they've established for themselves. I mean, I think Chance is a bit smarter than either one of these guys, right? Both business-wise and in terms of how he's creating his music. But at the end of the day, I had the same relationship with J. Cole that you did, which is, you know, someone like Drake, I'm just a straight Drake hater, right? But with J. Cole...
That's an unacceptable opinion, but okay, I'll let you have it.
Straight Drake hater. I mean, there is one Drake record I like. It's the one, I forget the name of it, The Way We Were, or... Things Were Never the Same. It's the one. Nothing was the same.
Okay.
That's a great record. That's great. But I mean, other than that, I mean, it's hard for me to. You know me. It's hard for me to wrap my head around what Drake represents. Okay.
Oh my god.
But sorry, dude. James. I'm sorry. But for J. Cole, I had a certain kind of resistance to him. I don't think the first record, Born Sinner, is it?
Yeah.
First record was super dope. But I had this. I had like a sort of religious experience with 2014 Forest Hills, which is. I listened to it, thought it was okay. A lot of cats I really respect, like you, said, yo, this record is dope. And then I saw the film, the Homecoming film. And, bruh, like, that film, I have not had an experience where a visual helped me to realize the music in
right.
a way more fully than that film.
I keep my head high. I got my wings carry me. I don't know free. My dreams to rescue me. I keep my faith strong. I ask the Lord to follow me. I've been unfaithful. I don't know why you call on me.
These three guys we're talking about, they're all M singers. They, you know, like, remember the line from the Jizzer? Like, these MCs are singing, you know, these M singers, like... And so I've had a little bit of an aversion to that. People have to understand, like, 50 Cent and Ja Rule were MCs who sang, okay? I have to come to terms with that a little bit, and with J. Cole especially, but the visuals helped me to understand the rawness of what he's trying to accomplish.
Okay, I want to play a J. Cole record right now.
Yep.
I want to play Neighbors from the new record.
Neighbors think I'm selling dope, Okay, the neighbors think I'm selling dope, selling dope, yeah. I don't want no picture with the president, I just wanna talk to the man. Speak for the boys in a bando, and my nigga never walking again. Apologize if I'm harping again. I know these things happen often, but I'm back on the scene. I was lost in a dream as I write this to teen down in Austin. I've been building me a house back home in the South, ma. Won't believe what it's costing, and it's fit for a king, right? Or a nigga that can sing and explain all the pain that it cost him. My 16 should have came with a coffin, the fame and the fortune. Well, maybe not the fortune, but one thing is for sure, the fame is exhausting. That's why I moved away. I needed privacy, surrounded by the trees in Ivy League. Students that's recruited higher league, thinking you do you and I do me. Crib has got a big old back of yard. My nigga stand outside and pass cigars. Filled with marijuana, laughing hard. Thankful that they friends are platinum star. In the driveway, there's no rapper cars. Just some to get from back and forth.
So to your point about J. Cole, I got to interview him recently, and Cole doesn't do a lot of press. He doesn't really talk very much. And I think on 2014 Forest Hills Drive, on this album, his version of doing press was doing these HBO shows, right?
Right.
It was like, I'm not going to talk to you, I'm not going to tell my story, but I'm going to narrate. I'm going to give you this sort of parallel narration.
Yep.
But in talking to him, I found that he was hungry to share this story. And the story that he shared was one of chasing all of the things that rap music, say post-Puffy, has taught us to want. You know, it's not religion, it's capitalism as religion, right? It's a, like, rapper, it became a character you played, you know?
Yep.
It wasn't, like, in 88, I hate that I'm a guy who's like, yo, in 88, but, like...
we're the old heads now.
But that's okay.
We're the old heads now.
But that's real. In 88, rapper was someone who rapped.
Right.
And, like, there was a flash associated with it, but it was not the dominant thing. And
that's
then
right.
Certainly I would say Biggie into Jay, and once Jay really becomes kind of, like, calcified as a figure in the late 90s, early 2000s, rapper became a character. It became someone who accumulates a lot of wealth, someone who runs a business, someone with, like, uncertain underworld connections that you're constantly alluding to. It became something that someone could play. And then you see that obviously leading into the Rick Ross era, someone who very clearly was lying about all those things and no one cared. People were just like, okay, cool. He sounds like the character, so it's totally fine. J. Cole.
Which makes him a caricature.
Sure, but also a very well-drawn one.
Yes.
But people accepted it, by and large. People accepted it, even though it seemed like they might not. Cole was someone who got fed into that same system, but right. still had these latent values that of the old times.
Yep.
You know, he grew up idolizing real storytelling rap, and he had that within him and had a kind of psychic break almost of saying, this isn't who I am. I understand I want to be a famous rapper because I love to rap and that's my job. But I am not this character.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then move home to North Carolina, married his longtime girlfriend, and decided I'm just going to make records about the things I know. And 2014 Forest Hills Drive was this intensely personal record that's a homecoming record. And then For Your Eyes Only is more of a character-driven record, but it's also stories from that same place.
Yep.
And I found that as a sort of story told from an interviewee to an interviewer, very moving and really compelling. But also, I could have told that story just from listening to the albums. Because I think you compare these last two J. Cole albums to the first two J. Cole albums, and they sound like they're coming from, I don't want to say a totally different person, but certainly a more enlightened version of
they're
the same
person.
They're
coming from totally different places.
Yes.
And John, there aren't a whole lot of scoops in hip-hop anymore. Your interview with J. Cole is a legit scoop, man, so congrats on that.
We try.
The reason why Neighbors is so dope to me is because the film, and again, I don't want to spoil the film for folks, but he basically is taking a tour of, like, certain hot spots from the Black Lives Matter movement and also in the South where he's from. And what he's showing you is the interiority of black life.
Yes.
Especially the interiority of black poor life. But on Neighbors, you can actually see clips of SWAT teams getting ready to run up into his crib. Not where he lives, but the crib where he and
his homies the recording studio is.
Where the recording studio is. And there's nothing there, essentially. But just to see the militarized police about to break into a domestic space and what that looks like, it's haunting.
Well, and it's interesting because when I was talking to him about the film, what I was thinking about the through lines, right, of all the places that he goes in the film. He goes to Jonesboro, Arkansas, which is where his father is from, and they go into that rec community center that has the Black History Room. He goes to Ferguson. He's obviously in Fayetteville, where he's from. And I felt like it was his personal narrative about the places, and it's obviously Southern specific, where America let black people down.
Yep.
Now, you could go anywhere in this country and tell personal stories of where America let black people down. I felt like this is his narrative thread through those choices was, I'm going to tell my story through a lens of these stories about how my father was let down and how I was let down and look what the police did to me. And also the fact that he's not even telling you that in the film. He's literally just listening. He's just watching.
Yeah.
Which is the most powerful thing. I mean, dog, we're here on a podcast. You and I are talking for an hour. It's what we, you know what I mean? Like, this is what
we
do. It's what we do.
But we're also both good listeners.
I would hope so.
Listening is a lost art amongst rap artists.
It's not a skill.
It's not. What's so striking about the film, you're right, is that you expect a rapper to be jumping into all these conversations, to be leveraging the dominance of their voice in the interiority of black life. But he's listening and absorbing. This is why J. Cole is going to have a long career, John, because at the end of the day, he's back home. He's in his wheelhouse. He doesn't have to play a character because the characters in his very existence, like where he's from and what he loves and what he knows, have stories forever.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so he's found the pot of gold in terms of being generative in terms of the music, and folks who see the film will appreciate that because we're not going to run out of those experiences.
No, and also this is an interesting moment in hip-hop. I want to bring it back to the music because I feel like a very lazy thing that people of our generation say about the dominant sound of the last few years, you know, your Drakes and post-Drakes. That it's not rapping, it's too melodic, you know, it doesn't reflect the rap values that we grew up with.
Right.
And I have a lot of quibbles with that argument, but I'll give it a pass just for the purpose of this particular moment. I'll give it a pass because I think what's so striking about Cole and Kendrick and Chance is this resuscitation of the values of 15 to 20 years ago. And I don't just mean that as far as the quality of rapping or the technical approach to the rapping. I mean in the musical selection. I mean in the grappling with issues of morality and Black history. These are things that they are making central to their art. Vince Staples also very much in this lane.
Yeah.
So important. And that I can't help but find heartening that is finding an audience now.
I ain't never ran from nothing but the police. I ain't never ran from nothing but the police. From the city where the skinny kept strong heat, Northside Long Beach. Northside Long Beach.
I have to just be honest with you, John. You know, I've never been one of these guys who, like, lost hope in hip-hop, even at the height of what people call mumble rap.
That's not a real thing, James.
I know.
Not a real thing.
I know.
You know who was a mumble rapper? Eric Sermon was a mumble rapper.
Hello. But listen, can these cats step their game up, like, on the real for real? Have you ever heard of impressionism before? Do you understand the affective of response to what you're calling mumble rap? Like, forget, that's a whole other podcast episode. But what these three artists represent in terms, you're right, this value system, and maybe value system is the wrong term, but in terms of what they're prepared to critically engage, of course it's heartening because, not because this stuff hasn't existed. For me, there's always been narrative, counter-narrative. Pick whatever moment you want, the height of gangster rap, the height of champagne rap, the height of whatever. I'll point you to an underground rapper that was killing it, and I was banging and listening to it and getting what I needed to get out of the culture. But what the difference here is, these guys are center stage. They're able to capture the kind of complexity that I think old heads like you and I, and hopefully a lot of other listeners, really appreciate. Because you know what? They are dedicated. You can not like them or like them, but you can't say they're not dedicated to perfecting the craft of what they do.
Yes. And also, I think it's important at the same time, I sometimes think that younger listeners who only listen to Kendrick or only listen to Cole, they don't know about the Freestyle Fellowship. They don't know about AC Alone. They don't know about Peace. Like, they don't know about the rappers who actually set the technical frameworks for what Kendrick does. I hear Kendrick rapping in certain patterns. It takes me directly back to 1992 or 1993 sometimes. And I don't know how directly schooled in that stuff he is, but maybe super schooled, maybe it's just filtered down. But it's sometimes I want to take people aside who are just like, no one's ever rapped like this. And I'm like, actually, fam, let me show you something real fast.
Once we have the knowledge to help us the people, then we can be free and no devil could ever enter the boundaries. I stand in the center around all these sounds I see. Blessed Allah that I found the key, that's how we be.
We are by no means ashamed of our cultural background. Not a tad bit afraid of change. Look around, the same old, same old.
What's going on, man?
Oh, no, I can't call it. Trying to maintain, overlooking these boundaries. I gotta be righteous, I gotta be me. I gotta be conscious, I gotta be free. I gotta be able, I gotta.
There's this underground group called Till and Villain Empire.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
They're gonna sound crazy, but they're gonna sound like Bone Thugs and Harmony to you, but
yes,
they were like way before Bone Thugs.
Way before. I mean,
but come on, guys. Mm-hmm. Listen to Three Stacks. You don't have to go back that far. If they don't want to go back to our underground, you know, stuff from the 80s and 90s, go back to Three Stacks.
I want to say, if you listen to Pride on the new Kendrick Lamar record, I actually had a moment where it came on the other day, and I was like, oh, I did not know Andre was on this record.
Exactly. Look, that's not to undermine.
No, it's not a shot.
Innovation.
It's not a shot.
It's just that when you're trying to acknowledge influence, this is scholars and critics alike, we have to dig a little deeper, right? This is what people tell me when they challenge my work. You know, you got to dig a little bit deeper. There are lots of inputs for someone like Kendrick Lamar or someone like Chance the Rapper or someone like J. Cole. Let's try to figure out and acknowledge all of them. They're not as inventive. They're innovative, but not as inventive as people would have them be.
Before we go, I want to take that challenge and reflect it back, at least onto me and my peers. J. Cole is someone who I think people really hate on him on the internet. He gets a lot of flack, and I understand why, because he chooses to rap about some unexpected subjects. He's rapping about losing his virginity, about folding clothes for his wife. These are things that, you know, we have certainly not been trained over the last 10 or 15 years to think are cool things and things that are worth celebrating in song. But at the end of this most recent Cole album, and we're talking after the Folding Clothes song, the last song, which is the title track, is this 9-minute song, and it's told from the perspective first of this character that Cole has created, grafted together from a couple of guys that he grew up with, street dudes, told from that character's perspective to Cole, and then later from Cole to that character's daughter. And it's carrying this story across generations, from the streets to the arts. All of these things are happening. And it's an interesting counterbalance with Kendrick's Duckworth, talking right. about the intersection of these two worlds create, and in Kendrick's case, the intersection creates great art. In Cole's case, his point is that he's made the art about the transition out of the street life. I found this last track on the Cole album incredibly moving, and we're going to go out with just a few seconds of it, but I want to encourage everybody to really listen to
it. Can I just say one quick thing about it?
Please.
Because this is the Miles Coltrane moment. All the jazz aficionados are going to hate me. This is the Miles Coltrane moment of hip-hop. Miles being K-Dot and Coltrane being J. Cole in this sense, right? That last record is very comparable to Duckworth, but look at what J. Cole is doing. His repudiation of the lifestyle that he's experienced around the hood. He goes through this litany of, like, you know, your father wasn't hard because he was a hustler or because he went to jail.
He was hard because he loved you.
Yes!
Oh, I don't even have children, and I lost it when I heard that line. All right, let's listen to a little bit of For Your Eyes Only with J. Cole.
One day your daddy called me, told me he had a funny feeling. What he been dealing with lately, he wasn't telling. I tried to pick his brain, still he wasn't revealing. But I could feel the sense of panic in his voice, and it was chilling. He said, Jermaine, I knew you since we was cheering. I never asked for nothing. When times was hard, I never had discussions with you, begging you to help me. I dealt with the repercussions of my actions. I know you tried to steer me away from that, but that was in my blood. You know my life. I know your mama. Send my love.
That's your podcast. Thank you for listening this week. Thank you to my guest, James Braxton Peterson. Go cop one of his books at Amazon. You probably need to rack out because there's just a lot of books. So it's going to cost a lot of money, apparently. James, thank you for being with us today. I appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me, man. Tell your listeners to subscribe to my podcast.
That's right.
The Remix. It's not as big as yours, but I want to be one day.
You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can email us your questions and thoughts, podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to us at Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer's Pedro Rosado. We're back next week.
Don't you ever scratch or disrespect it. This perspective is a real one. Another lost veil, son. I dedicate these words to you and all the other children affected by the mass incarceration in this nation that sent your pops to prison when he needed education. Sometimes I think this segregation would have done us better.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.